Gavin Newsom's inauguration as California's next governor is Monday on the west steps of the Capitol. Live coverage on Cap Radio begins at 11 a.m. Today, more reflection on the impact of the current governor, Jerry Brown. On Insight, LA Times political reporter Melanie Mason will join me, and we'll talk through some of Governor Brown's legislative record. Joel Metzger had a chance encounter with the governor in the small Sierra town of Vallecito.
After the first 5 minutes, it felt entirely natural to talk to the governor.
Joel, his wife Emily, and their baby daughter were gardening in the front yard when it happened. It's a great story. You'll hear Joel tell it. And later in the hour, Dr. Brandi Waite has advice on keeping New Year's fitness resolutions. I know, you're skeptical, right? She says you actually can make a New Year's promise work. We'll hear all about it. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Governor Brown is in headlines from coast to coast lately. Have you noticed? He's on television, radio, he's in print. The California Today column of the New York Times has called it Jerry Brown's long non-farewell tour. He will, though, leave office Monday after a career of public service in California, including 16 years as governor. In the studio with me is LA Times political reporter Melanie Mason, who has followed Governor Brown literally and figuratively through his last stint as governor. Glad to have you here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
So, Melanie, how important a transition would this be from Governor Jerry Brown to anyone else in light of what these last 8 years have been?
Well, I think there's two things. The first is that Jerry Brown is such a singular political figure here in California. I mean, the fact that he served 16 years as governor, that he served in the 70s, and then now we kind of had Jerry Brown 1.0 and 2.0. And so I think because of that, we saw probably the most developed arc of any politician that we've really seen in that state. So I think because of that, whoever was going to follow him, that would have been such a tall order. And I think particularly in light of these last 8 years, think of what we had when Jerry Brown came into office in 2011. We were in the midst of a major recession. There was a $27 billion budget deficit. And since then, the economy has been on the upswing, right? And so we're in the middle of this very prolonged economic expansion. And economists will tell you that's probably not going to last very much longer. So I think the handoff to whomever the next governor would be is really the question of what happens when the economy goes south again.
Will Jerry Brown always be credited with California recovering, or even a bolder word than that, rebounding and getting back to forward motion?
I've seen some people say, and I think this is a really great way to say it, that Jerry Brown showed that California could be governable. And I think it's fair to say that he does not deserve all of the credit for that. I think actually the voters deserve a lot of credit, because when they passed Proposition 25, which changed the budget from needing a supermajority, a two-thirds vote to be approved, to a majority vote, that's when you stopped seeing those months overdue budgets where all of a sudden things would drag into August, September without a budget, and there would be all these headlines of the California crisis. Now the budgets are relatively drama-free moments, and so I think the voters deserve a tremendous amount of credit for that. But I also think that Brown, in the sort of fiscally prudent figure that he cut, the idea of paddling a little to the left, a little to the right, which is the sort of token Jerry Brown cliche, I think did show that California doesn't always have to be on the precipice. It doesn't always have to feel like we're on the brink of a disaster, and you can have a somewhat stable government.
I recorded a conversation late yesterday with former California Governor Gray Davis. We're airing it Monday, but for people who will hear it, they'll say the governor is echoing what you just said, Melanie, because he makes a lot of the exact same points, and he was the governor who was recalled by voters. So he certainly has that understanding of where budgets were then, what the issues were then, and has some good views on what Gavin Newsom will face. Let's talk about Jerry Brown's accomplishments. Beyond the turnaround of the state, what else is going to be marked and known for his term, his last two terms?
I think that the first thing that comes to mind is his advocacy around climate change. And that's a way where he really elevated. There were statewide policies when we talk about the state's cap and trade mechanisms and other ways that the state is looking to combat combat the effects of climate change. But he really elevated the state to almost this quasi-national presence, right? And so you would see Jerry Brown travel to China, travel to Paris, not as a representative of the United States of America, but as a representative of California. But California being the economic powerhouse that it is, the population powerhouse that it is, we had to be taken seriously as this entity. And I think that he was very deliberate in making climate change a central part of his tenure. And the second I would say is criminal justice. He really talked about criminal justice reform, revisiting, quite frankly, some of the decisions that he made in his first go-round as governor in the 70s, and looking at do we have too strict sentencing? Are we really looking at how best to reintegrate people who had served in prison into society? And so we saw massive changes in terms of what were considered felonies as opposed to misdemeanors, who would be going to prison as opposed to local jails, all under his tenure. And I think that if you total it all up, it's a real massive shift in criminal justice in this state.
I don't know what he might continue to do in the arena of criminal justice, but certainly he'll stay an international figure and a player in the discussion and the movement of policy in climate change.
I think that climate change, absolutely. And I would argue with criminal justice, too, he's already signaled. And I think part of that is because we will continue to see some backlash to some of the reforms that he has put into place. So, for example, there's an effort on the 2020 ballot to roll back some of the criminal justice reforms that were passed over the last couple of years. And he has indicated that he plans to push back against that rollback. And he said that he sees that to be a fundamentally sort of anti-Christian effort and sort of not looking at the possibility of redemption. And so I do anticipate him being very active on both those fronts, regardless if he holds an elected post or not.
There are issues he didn't touch. And in a conversation recently with Cap Radio's Ben Adler, he was using more the word couldn't touch, or the phrase couldn't touch, saying some things were just not doable in the leadership or the realm of the governor because there wasn't the same appetite among lawmakers. But let's hit on some of those issues, one being tax reform.
Yeah, I was about to say tax reform is the one that really jumps out. And it was so interesting because Governor Brown used to great effect talking about our volatile tax system, the fact that we are so dependent on the wealthiest residents of the state for so much of our revenue, that if they have a good year in the stock market, that's a very good thing for the state. If they have a not so good, it's a calamitous thing for the state. And so he would get out there every budget and he would have the same chart that would show the up and down sort of peaks and valleys of capital gains revenues. And he used that as a reason to say we can't overcommit ourselves in terms of spending. We need to be very prudent. But he never actually wanted to take on the underlying fundamentals of what is driving that volatility. He makes the point that to do that means taking on a lot of political third rails. It could mean broadening the tax base, which means raising taxes on lower and middle income people. That's not a very politically popular thing to do. It could be touching Proposition 13, which has been seen as a third rail in politics since the 70s. And I think that he has made this argument to Ben Adler and to others that if there is not that appetite to take on tax reform, what could he do? I would argue that he, being this sort of singular figure in the state, probably had more political capital and political acumen to take on such a tough issue. The fact that he chose not to just shows how difficult it is.
He also noted, though, that coming into office, Gavin Newsom is more accustomed to contention. And as mayor of San Francisco, has dealt with more contentious factions and issues than Jerry Brown had coming into the governor's office. And perhaps in that, he's saying Gavin Newsom might be more equipped right out of the box for some of these fights than Jerry Brown was.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, there's nothing like the blood sport of San Francisco politics. And I think it is interesting, and it's going to be important for us to keep in mind going forward and looking at Governor-elect Newsom. He ran as this unabashed liberal, and he is certainly very progressive when it comes to big ticket issues. But we should remember when he ran as mayor of San Francisco, he was seen as the quote unquote conservative candidate in San Francisco. All politics is relative, right? The spectrum in San Francisco is kind of left and leftier. But I do think that when we look at the sweeping proposals that Newsom has made and has talked about, we should always keep in mind that he was kind of seen as the business-friendly or more moderate Democrat, at least in the world of San Francisco.
I'm talking with LA Times political reporter Melanie Mason, who has been based in Sacramento, but not for long. Some congratulations are in order here.
Thank you. Yeah, breaking news.
Yeah, tell me about the job change, because I think you're moving very soon to LA.
Yes, so I'll be moving next week to Los Angeles. I'll be working out of the LA Times mothership, which I'm very excited about because I haven't done that before. And I'll be moving from focusing on state politics, the state capital, to looking more nationally. I'll be jumping right into the 2020 presidential race, which has already started, even though we are 4 days into 2019. I'm excited to join our team there.
Melanie, I credit you with being the one, but among a very few reporters who broke the We Said Enough Me Too stories that happened. They emerged at the Capitol in October of 2017. Talk to me about Governor Brown and the Me Too or We Said Enough movement, where he did and didn't make a place or a statement.
You know, there were so many bills that were introduced in the wake of this Me Too conversation here at the Capitol. I think there was a lot of efforts both internally at the Capitol to look at it in itself and how it handles sexual harassment complaints within that building, but also more broadly, what can they do in the workplace? What can they do to address things in Hollywood or tech? So there were a lot of bills that were passed, and Brown had kind of a mixed record in terms of what he signed and what he vetoed. He okayed a bill that would ban the use of secret settlements in some of these sexual harassment cases, because people say that that was a way to hide people's bad activities and maybe allow them to do those to other people. He also vetoed some bills that I know that labor groups were particularly passionate about, such as a bill that would end this idea of forced arbitration, saying that employees couldn't go to court to deal with these disputes. They had to settle it with an outside mediator. But I think that the more interesting thing about how he handled this issue was how little he spoke about it, how little he actually talked about what was really this massive upheaval that was going on in the building that he worked. And let's contrast that with, say, Governor-elect Newsom. So we saw a couple of months ago that there were allegations of sexual misconduct against Democratic Party Chair Eric Bauman. Within 24 hours of the LA Times publishing a story that had some specifics about these allegations, Gavin Newsom called on Eric Bauman to resign. We had asked all of the sort of major political figures of the state what they thought of the story. Jerry Brown never got back to us for comment at all, and he never really commented about any of these individual figures. I think this goes to show sort of Jerry Brown's approach to weighing in on, quote, the news of the day. He really didn't see the need to pontificate or opine on what was ever in the headlines in that day. And he was very deliberate about where he wanted to weigh in and where he didn't. But that was one where it really stood out, where I think it was on a topic that everybody was talking mm-hmm. about except for him.
Mm-hmm. Did you try? Did you have moments where you directly, one-on-one, attempted to engage him in that conversation?
No. To be clear, it's not like he would blow off the question. Very hard governor to cover for reporters. It's not like we had tons of access to him. And so a lot of times it would just be going to his spokespeople. And to be fair, so much of the activity was really focused on the legislative side. And so it was more sort of pressing legislative leaders about how they feel about what was going on among their colleagues in their house. But again, it is just Gavin Newsom chose to sort of stick his neck out and take this very firm position. And I think that it was comparing that to the absence of that from Jerry Brown that I think shows the two different styles of these men.
I want to ask you about two more issues that maybe would be in the category of what Governor Brown chose not to step deeply into. One, you could argue, would be the state's housing crisis, where he did or didn't involve himself there. And the other would be the issue of fracking and these accusations about his relationship with Big Oil that followed him throughout his time in office.
Sure. So to take on housing first, it's fascinating because he seems to have this really fatalistic view of the housing crisis here in California. And one of the exit interviews he did, I believe with NPR, he sort of said, if you come back 4 years from now, we're going to have the same problem. This is, of course, as his successor is promising that we're going to build millions of more units and address the affordability crisis. And so he really sort of gives off the sense that he sees this as an intractable problem. And I think one that also is indicative indicative of the larger problems undergirding our economy, both in the state and nationally, this idea of this huge income gap, income inequality, and that you will have in places like the Bay Area and Los Angeles, people with extremely high incomes driving up the demand for housing. And since there hasn't been enough housing built to settle that demand, prices are just are skyrocketing because of that. And folks that aren't maybe pulling down a tech salary are feeling like they're left out of the cold. But the fact that he didn't feel very gripped and sort of said, well, I guarantee you'll be a problem in 4 years. That's pretty stunning given how much the housing crisis is on everybody's mind in the state. And with regards to fracking, I think that that is, again, indicative of this, the idiosyncrasies of Jerry Brown, right? Because we were just talking about how much climate change was a driving force for him and how getting the future of the cap and trade system in the state secured was such a huge priority for him. And yet at the same time, when there were efforts by liberal Democrats to push for a moratorium on fracking, that was not something that he got behind. And he talked about the tremendous economic potential behind fracking. And I think that's because he was very aware that there's a balance here in pursuing these types of policies. And if there was a sense of pursuing, say, a ban on fracking and at the same time cap and trade and at the same time, you know, myriad other climate change programs, if that was seen as driving up the cost of energy, for example, could there be a backlash to that? And so, again, to go back to that cliche, a little to the left, a little to the right, I think that the fracking approach was an example of Jerry Brown choosing not to go all in with the environmentalists and what they want, but trying to find a middle ground and with industry and others who maybe are a little bit wary of aggressive climate change policies.
For you, as a political reporter, what's the imprint that you're left with from your time of covering him, watching him, learning from him, at times laughing with him and at things that he would say? What goes with you?
I think that the thing that I have learned the most watching him is the strategy or the deliberate use of not swinging at every pitch. Almost every politician that I've watched and or covered, they desperately want to be in the headlines. They want to talk about the news of the day. They're flattered when reporters want to talk to them. And with Brown, that really wasn't the case. And as a reporter, that was tremendously frustrating because that sort of intrinsic need to be loved that most politicians have, I don't think Brown really cared if reporters loved him or not. But I also think that as frustrating as that was, what I did learn a lot was that when he did weigh in, because it happened less often, it was more powerful. And so I think that as a political observer, watching him and his aides, his strategists, think about when to use him to greatest effect, I learned a lot watching that.
So a final question to the new press corps that will be at the state capitol, people based in Sacramento covering the new governor, Gavin Newsom. What do you expect for them? What's wise for reporters to know? And how different will it be?
I think it'll be tremendously different. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be a great beat. You can hear it in my voice maybe that I'm a little bit jealous of my colleagues, particularly those at the LA Times Bureau, because I think they're going to have a great time. But I think that, you know, the first year in particular, because you have somebody like Newsom who is following such a towering figure like that of Brown, it might be a little bit rocky as he sort of finds his sea legs into this place. And so I think that for the reporters who will be covering, I think that establishing early on the expectations, pushing for accountability, for transparency. It doesn't have to be a combative relationship between the press and the governor, but it should be aggressive and there should be a little bit of give and take. And I think that if my colleagues in the press corps can sort of set that early and say, we watched you on the campaign, we know what you promised, and we're going to see if you follow through or not, I think it'll be a very informative and valuable couple of years.
Melanie, thank you for making time, as you have over your years here, to join us on Insight and share with us the reporting that you've done. It's really been a privilege and a pleasure to work with you.
Oh, it's my honor. Thank you so much.
And I hope it happens again, even with a new job.
Yes, I hope I'll have an excuse to swing through.
Melanie Mason with the LA Times, the statewide politics reporter, now moving to the national beat. And Monday, Gavin Newsom will become California's next governor. That's probably Melanie's last statewide assignment, right?
That's it.
We'll focus on the transition on Insight. Our live coverage in partnership with KQED begins at 11 a.m. Governor Newsom's oath is scheduled at noon from the west steps of the Capitol. Thanks again, Melanie. Good luck. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.
It's come to pass. The Indians had a legend. The Spaniards lived for gold. The white men came and killed them, but they haven't really gone.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Joel Metzger says his chance encounter with Governor Jerry Brown back in October was serendipitous. Joel and his wife Emily and their baby daughter were working in the front yard of their home in Vallecito, which is a small foothills town of about 500 people. During the gold rush, though, it was a bustling city of thousands. And that little bit of history is a clue to this random meeting. Joel is the former editor of the Calaveras Enterprise. He's been a guest on Insight before. He now works with the Calaveras County Water District. And we got him on the phone recently to tell the story.
On that Sunday afternoon, we were doing some gardening out in our front yard. We have a house in Vallecito, which is a quaint, small town that many, many years ago was a gold mining town of many thousands of people. But now it's a small, tight-knit community. And my wife and I are avid gardeners, and so we were out in the front yard. And as with everyone in the fall, you are kind of cleaning out your summer crops and putting some winter crops in. So we were doing that. I had baby Kate, who was about 10 months at the time, on my back. And we were just doing gardening as a family. And across the street from our house in Vallecito is a very large stone building that's clearly historical. The stone is all hand cut and just looks old and beautiful. And so in front of this building, a large dark colored SUV pulled up with tinted windows, and a couple people got out and they went up to the neighbor's house, which is in this old store. And they just started kind of poking around and looking at it and talking. And then they would call someone on the cell phone, and I just heard little bits of conversation about what they were looking at. And one of the gentlemen who got out of the vehicle just seemed somehow strangely familiar to me. I couldn't quite place why I thought this person was familiar, but there was something that seemed to be familiar to me. And so we just continued with our gardening. The folks kept talking about this house across the street, and it kind of got strange because they just didn't leave. They must have been there for a half an hour, and they just continued walking around this building. I started to get a little concerned that, you know, what's going on here? You know, why are they looking at this so closely? My neighbors weren't home, and so I was getting a little protective about their house. And so I thought, well, maybe I should go over and just see if these folks need some assistance, make sure everything's in order. And I was about to go over, and then the SUV left. And I thought, oh, man, okay, I guess, you know, they're going to move on to somewhere else, so this is all okay. And then I went and did a little chore. And then I came back, and the SUV had showed up again, and they were looking at the house again across the street. So finally, I just said, I'm going to go, and I'm going to see what this is all about. So I walked across the street, and they had just gotten back in the car, and they started the engine. They were about to leave. So within a couple seconds, they would have been gone. And I just walked right up to the driver's side window. And there was a gentleman who appeared to be a security guard who was driving. And I introduced myself and said, I'm just from across the street. I wanted to make sure that everything was okay here. And I looked across the security guard to the front passenger seat. And I just knew immediately that that was Governor Brown sitting there. And so I kind of awkwardly just said, are you Governor Brown? And he looked over and he kind of smiled and said, yes, I am. And then I just kind of thought, oh, my goodness, what is the governor of California doing in my small town in rural California? And so I just asked him, I said, so what brings you here? And he went on to say that he had family history in the town that goes all the way back to the 1800s, and that he was here trying to figure out whether he could find the remnants of his grandfather, great-great-grandfather's old store, which apparently had existed in the town back in the 1850s. And he said his grandfather's name was Giovanni Cuneo. And I knew the Cuneo name, and I knew I'd seen it in some documents that I had about the town. And so I said, well, if you're interested, I have a very old map of the town that goes back at least 100-120 years. And if you'd like to come take a look at it, we can see if we can find anything that might lead you to where this store was. And I also told him that the beautiful store that he had been looking at across the street from my house was actually called the Dinkelspiel store. And it also goes back to the 1850s, but it was not ever owned by a Cuneo. So that wasn't the building he was looking for. And so he said, I would love to see that map. So he said, give us a few minutes and we'll come in and take a look. So I just invited him to park in front of my house. And then I went back into my yard, and Emily had gone inside with baby Kate at this point. And so I went to the front door, and she was sitting there with the baby. And I said, babe, the governor of California is outside our front door, and he wants to come and look at some of the old maps of town. Would you be okay with that? And she looked up at me like I was the craziest person in the world, and just total disbelief. Like, you know, sometimes I joke with her, so this clearly must have been that. And I tried to impress upon her, no, this is real. We actually have the governor right outside of our house, and he wants to come in. And so she kind of realized after I'd repeated myself maybe 10 times that I wasn't joking with her. And then we both kind of just got an adrenaline rush, and oh my goodness, we're going to have the governor in our house. So she ran into the back room to find the old map of Vallecito. I ran to try to find some other documents that might help him with his quest to find his family history. And then a few minutes later, I just peeked through the window, and here comes Governor Brown and his wife, Anne, walking up our front walkway. And so I opened the door, and they came right on in, big smiles, you know, greeted us warmly. And I introduced my family to both of them, and they introduced themselves. And then we crowded around our dining room table, and we just looked at maps for quite some time and looked at old names and where the properties used to be and tried to find something that might ring a bell for the Cuneo family. And the map that I had ended up being a little bit too young. I mean, it was too recent. And so it didn't have the Cuneo family. They had already sold the building at that point. And so that led to just getting into conversation. I ended up talking to Governor Brown, and Emily and Kate ended up talking to Anne. And I just will never forget standing in our home and just really having very friendly, warm conversation with both of them. They were both very inquisitive, very bright, you know, asked a lot of questions about us and what we do and what we're passionate about. Governor Brown was really interested in my experience with water legislation and water use. And we talked about some of the policies that he's worked on involving groundwater and surface water and water conservation. And then we ended up giving them a tour of our front yard and talking about how we'd taken our lawn out and put more water efficient landscaping in. And then he asked me how much water I used. And I don't think many people could answer that, but since I'm in the water industry, I was able to tell him what the actual water usage was with the lawn and then after we put the drought tolerant landscaping in. And we talked about water policy in general. And then he also told me about his plans, and he's going to be leaving office very soon, and that he is very excited to spend time on his ranch north of Sacramento, and he grows olives up there. My family also grows olives on a farm in San Andreas, so we had lots of good conversation about agriculture and his excitement about building a library and living off-grid on his ranch. And we just had it just felt like an old friend had stopped by, and we were catching up on, you know, what each other were doing with our lives. And, you know, after the first 5 minutes, it felt entirely natural to talk to the governor, which I thought was really neat and a testament to his ability to simply be a real, warm human being who was interested and genuine. And so it's an experience that I will not soon forget. My wife won't soon forget. And I love that we were able to take a picture with Governor Brown and Ann and my wife and baby Kate that we'll always keep on our mantle. Even before she has memories, Kate will have spent a little time with a governor of California, which is pretty neat.
You can see that picture on our website. That was Joel Metzger talking about the random meeting that his family had with Governor Jerry Brown and his wife, Ann. Joel says nothing specific was discovered that day, but the governor asked Joel to keep him informed. They have since figured out the location of that Cuneo store. And the ruins of the building, it turns out, had been demolished some years ago, but Joel says the rhyolite stone from the building has been kept on a nearby property. So the Brown family apparently has a rich history with Cuneos all across the area. Joel says he and the governor will continue to stay in touch. And of course, there's a standing invitation for the governor and his wife, Ann, to return to Vallecito anytime. You can see the photo at capradio.org/insight. There's still more ahead in this hour. This is Insight on Cap Radio.
I wish I had a needle and thread, fine as I could sew, so that pretty gal to my side and down the road I'd go. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. Some come here to fiddle and dance, some come here to tarry. Some come here to fiddle and dance, I come here to marry. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. We are about 1 week into the new year. How are those resolutions going? Especially the ones that had to do with going to the gym or to a yoga class, maybe cross training. Any of those new fitness routines seem to be a challenge in January, unless you're super inspired. And then what happens? Dr. Brandi Waite from UC Davis Health Sports Medicine is a fitness evangelist, I think we'll call her. I'm hoping she has some good guidance. Hi, Dr. Waite. Happy New Year.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we are 1 week in. What's the likelihood that most of us are still on track at this point with the New Year's promises?
1 week in, people are still doing pretty well, unless they had a really fantastic New Year's Eve. Then sometimes even New Year's Day, you've fallen off before you've started. It gets to be by about the end of January or early to mid-February is when a lot of people struggle with maintaining those initial fitness goals.
I have been in this business a long, long time, so I have had dozens of these kinds of conversations. So I do feel a little skeptical about whether there can be any new advice or new guidance on how to do this. But it is a tradition that I really buy into, and I believe in the hope of a new year. How do you come at it?
You know, I think that every day is really an opportunity to start a new resolution. But since so many people just kind of grab on to New Year's Day, at least you get one chance a year among many chances that you have in the year to start doing something that's better for yourself. And so I think if it kind of gets you off the couch and at least gets you started, you've got a chance. And if you don't ever get off the couch and get started, you have zero chance. So if we'll take that one chance a year to get people to buy in.
Right. You work with our physical bodies, but how much of this is psychological and mental discipline?
A lot of it is emotional and discipline, and creativity plays a part as well. You know, lots of people can be very disciplined, but the reality is life gets in the way. There's very few of us that just have ample free time to easily take care of all of our fitness needs. And so it's figuring out ways when life throws you that curveball to keep something going so you don't completely fall off the wagon.
Do you have an example, maybe an example from your own life or somebody you've worked with about that navigating of life and goals?
You know, I see a lot of patients that have come to us because they have an injury that has thrown them off from their fitness plan. Oh, I wanted to do this couch to 5K because I got really motivated with my girlfriends and then I got plantar fasciitis. Or, you know, I started this cross training program and then I got tennis elbow. And so that's when I kind of make my intervention for people. So number one is if something hurts, get it taken care of. It doesn't have to be the end of your goal. But number two is you can shift your goal as long as you don't abandon it. I think that's really it. So I've seen people who really, you know, came in. One woman I'm thinking of in particular, she had a great kind of charity goal that she really wanted to work for in honor of someone in her family. And she ended up with a foot problem that was limiting her ability to walk and train. And she said, well, if I can't do that, what can I do? And we shifted her from walking to a pool program, actually, to help keep her cardiovascular fitness up while she was healing from this foot injury. And there's actually been studies that show that exercising in the pool can keep you on track with out-of-pool goals. And she did it. She was able to get back into it, and she walked her 5K. And it wasn't a spectacular ultramarathon finish, but it was a finish for her, and that's what her realistic goal was. And so it was great. She was so fulfilled when she got it done. And that was really just wonderful to see the joy that she had from having something get in the way, finding a way to overcome it, and getting back on track.
Mm-hmm. The creative problem solving there that you talk about. It's easy to slip into a sense of failure or bombing out on yourself when you aren't going to the class you promised you'd go to every week, or you bought the gym membership, but the money is going out of your account and the work isn't happening with you physically.
Yes, you know, I really say if you bought it, use it or get rid of it. Right. So if 3 months have gone by and it's not that convenient for you to go to that gym that you bought a membership for or that class that you really thought you were going to like, then get rid of it and replace it with something else that you can really do. So instead of just holding on to something because you said, oh, I said I was going to do this specific class and now I haven't done it. If it didn't work, adjust and transfer to the next thing.
You're listening to Dr. Brandi Waite, sports medicine expert with UC Davis. Most of the people you work with are athletes on some level, correct?
I work with a lot of athletes and professional athletes, recreational athletes, weekend warriors, and then many of my patients, they're, you know, athletic goals are really just being able to garden and keep up with their grandkids. So we really can see the spectrum.
Yeah, and that's what I wondered, how ordinary the advice can be to everybody across the board, even if you're working with somebody at a very elite level. What applies to all of us?
So at the very elite level, you know, people's paycheck is tied to their fitness, so they have
that's
a different
true.
Motivator.
Right.
You know, they've got, responsibilities to their team and to keep a paycheck coming in for their family. And so that's a different motivator than those of us that maybe have just personal fitness goals or really health goals to help decrease their blood pressure or help control your diabetes. And so there are things that motivate professionals that don't apply to us regular folks. And so it's finding reasons that are relevant to your specific situation to help keep you on track. You're not going to sign a $1 million contract to walk a 5K, right? So that's not a reasonable thing. But finding something that you can tie it to that makes sense to you and is important to you in your day-to-day life, in your month-to-month life, in your year-to-year life, that's really more important for everyone.
Give me a small starting place, a number one recommendation for anybody who just wants to be more fit.
Get off the couch.
Okay.
All right. So and if your knees and legs and feet hurt you so much, exercise on the couch. That's another thing that you actually can do. But I think it's just getting started, having a written plan and actually putting it on your calendar as if it's another meeting or another something scheduled that you can't shortchange. That's really important. And recommitting yourself to it every month.
Getting off the couch isn't earth-shattering advice, you know that. But I do like one thing you recommend, which is just 30 minutes a day. And the last day or two, people are taking down their holiday decorations, putting things away. You may not even realize it, but maybe you just spend 30 minutes really briskly walking or lifting boxes or doing something, and you accomplished the 30 minutes.
Absolutely. You know, if house cleaning could really keep you as fit as you need to be, a lot of us would be fitter than we are.
So I think about it, don't you?
Yes, you have to step up your game a little bit. Maybe turn on some music and, you know, kind of dance a little bit in between as you're picking those things up. Or after you've moved one box, maybe do 10 high knee lifts or something like that. Just work a little bit more in to what you're already doing. It doesn't have to be 30 minutes on the treadmill or a 30-minute walk around the block. You can do little bits of mini exercise throughout the day to add up, because it's hard to find 30 minutes sometimes.
Sensible goals.
Oh, yes.
What are they?
Well, if you've never run, don't set the goal of running a marathon in March, you know, as your thing. You want to be realistic, really smart, very specific, measurable. We want these SMART goals as an acronym that people use for goal setting, and it's specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. And so those are the things you want to pay attention to. So if you have a goal, don't make it, I want to be more active this year, or I want to lose weight this year. Be more specific. I want to exercise 5 days a week. And how you're going to do that might change, you know, depending on what your level of fitness is. Or I'm going to exercise 3 days a week, or I'm going to exercise a little bit every day. And those are things that are a little bit more specific.
Have you made a New Year's resolution? Do you have a fitness goal?
I do have a fitness goal. I'm really good at sticking to I'm one of those crazy, like,
yeah,
you know, very dedicated people. Last year, my New Year's resolution was not to buy any new clothes. A random one, and I only bought a pair of ski pants. That was my one. I needed some that fit. I couldn't find the ones that fit. But for fitness goals in particular, this year my goal, I have three exercises that I identified that I want to do every day. I want to do 30 push-ups every day, 50 sit-ups every day, and 20 squats every day.
Okay. How's it going?
I've done them so far.
All right.
I do them when I brush my teeth. I do squats when I brush my teeth. The folks that I work with, they always joke about me and my toothbrushing exercise. Or when you're standing up typing, you can do hamstring curls if you're standing at a computer. So just finding little ways to fit it in. And I've done pretty good so far. If you just do it when you first get up in the morning, I mean, my fitness goal only takes about, I don't know, 3 minutes to do. So I could really do it more than once a day if I were really dedicated to it. But that was my goal, once a day. That way I never fall completely off and have long periods of time with nothing.
Did you write it down, or are you marking it on a calendar? I notice you're not wearing a Fitbit.
I'm not wearing a Fitbit. I do have a watch that tracks my steps in a day, but I didn't tie it to steps in a day because for me that isn't a good motivator. It works really well for other people. Great. If it works for you, use it. It doesn't work for me. So I just keep that. But yes, I have marked on my calendar. It gets a little check on the day that my number one to do fitness quickie, and then it gets checked off.
Would you go through the SMART acronym one more time?
Sure, SMART. So people use this in business, but it's very applicable to fitness goals. So you want to be specific. So again, not I'm going to exercise more, but specific about the exercise that you're going to do. Measurable. So you've got to be able to measure it 3 days a week, 4 days a week, 5 days a week, 2 days a week, you know, something like that. You've got to be able to measure it. SMA, attainable, right? Again, don't set an ultra marathon as your goal if you've never been a runner. So you want it to be something that's really physically possible for you to do, and relevant. So if you have no desire to walk a 5K, don't set a 5K as your goal. That's not really relevant to you. It might be find something else. The exercise that's best for you is the exercise you most enjoy, right? Some people have never found an exercise they enjoy, so they've got to do a little research to find it. So that's relevant. And then time bound. So if you put a little bit of urgency to it, have weekly goals or monthly goals. You just don't set it for the whole year because, you know, March might roll around and you've done nothing towards it. Then you're very unlikely to get back going with it. So more time-bound intermediate goals.
You're listening to Dr. Brandi Waite from UC Davis Health Sports Medicine. I've called her a fitness evangelist. I think I've probably convinced you that she is right now. So to talk about a specific program, you do have something called Busy But Fit. And what's the concept of Busy But Fit?
So Busy But Fit stemmed from some of my own experiences. You know, I'm a mom. I've got two kids. I work full time. I teach in the medical school. My story is not different than many other people's stories. They've got family that they take care of. They've got work responsibilities, and they've got, you know, relationships they're trying to maintain. And that doesn't always leave time. People are very busy, but you don't have to be busy and unfit. You can be busy but fit. And so it was my way of kind of creating little bits of mini workouts or things that were really attainable for people that have a very busy schedule.
So just on the chance that where you are in your life has a story behind it that might inspire someone else, would you give me a bit of the journey that got you from probably a young, really active kid through school to the work that you're doing right now?
Sure, sure. It's funny. I started off as a dancer when I was a young girl, and then I went to college and I still danced a little bit. As a pre-med student, there's a lot of demands on your time, but somehow, you know, I really loved my dance and I kept doing it. And I took a year off, actually, in between college and medical school, and I planned to do research, but this opportunity came up for me to work at a fitness resort teaching aerobics. This was back in the day when, like, step aerobics and high-low aerobics were in vogue. And so I took, after graduating from Stanford University and en route to an equally sort of prestigious medical school, I took a year off and spent that whole year doing fitness activities. And that at the time, I thought I wanted to do a different medical specialty. I thought I wanted to be an OBGYN. I didn't think sports medicine was really in it for me because I thought you had to be an orthopedic surgeon, which I didn't particularly care to be. Mm. Then I found this other pathway into sports medicine. And because of the people that I met during this fitness resort time, or regular people coming and trying to recharge their lives, other people that I thought were the same age as me that were actually 15 or 20 years older than me because they had done a great job taking care of themselves and were very active, I said, I need to figure out how to do that in this very busy part of my life, because from working at a fitness resort to being a medical student are about as far apart in activity levels as you can imagine. And so that just really brought it home for me that and then as a medical student, I saw patients who weren't able to take care of themselves physically fit, and people I thought were much older than me that were really younger than me, and just their whole body showed sort of the weight of their experiences and inability to really take care of their physical body. So it really inspired me to say, all right, there's something we can do about it, because I've seen old folks who look young and young folks who look old, and some sort of physical activity seems to be one of the keys in making that transition to being a little more positive. So that's really where I was inspired. And then I had kids and everything got even more busy. And so just this thought that you've got to spend an hour a day or even 30 minutes all at once a day is just not realistic for a lot of people where they are. There's no substitute for being able to do that. So I don't want to say, oh, yeah, if you know, do squats for 5 minutes, it's just as good as a regular exercise program. That's not what I'm saying. But if you don't have the time to do it, you don't have to completely be sedentary. So it really inspired me. I try to practice what I preach, and I've got to work at it. I'm not one of those people with a naturally high metabolism, but if I can't do it myself with my busy life, it would be hypocritical for me to tell my patients that they could do it. So I've got to walk the walk, and I can pretty much come up with some sort of exercise plan for just about anyone mm-hmm. and how to do it hopefully without injuring themselves.
What I hear in your story is along the lines of what you say to everybody in terms of a fitness routine, and especially at this point, which is try going the simple route. Try keeping it simpler.
Yes. You know, the folks who are, you know, really good at their exercise program that post about it all the time on Facebook and, you know, do all these other things, have a certain drive or desire that's moving them. And not everyone can identify with that drive or desire. And so if you try to do something big and spectacular, there's a lot of steps to big and spectacular that you can fall off. If you just start simple and make it really basic, you can get great results for your health and for yourself and for just your emotional well-being of having accomplished a task that you set for yourself. If you set simple ones, then they can grow. If you just set the big ones and fall off the rails before you get there, that's a little more challenging.
Because you mentioned kids, the conversation we're having isn't just for grown-ups. That starting all of this, incorporating your kids in the routine and the fun of it when they're young is really important.
It is. You know, back when I was in college, actually, I even worked, there was a study that was just showing how our children's health and physical activity is just going down over the years. They're not playing outside as much. There are many things that caused it. But, you know, you've got to incorporate healthy activity when you're young, because you're more likely to sustain healthy activity if you did it when you were a kid than if you were a sedentary kid. Starting as an adult can be really tough. And we've got to help those kids, you know, in any way we can. So giving them some good healthy basics is ideal.
Well, Dr. Wade, can you tell that I've been trying from every possible angle to give people something to hang on to encourage and make us all believe that we can be more fit, we can be better, we can be happier this year. I always like to look at life that way. And if we can look at it with our goals in mind, then we will make it a better year.
I really think so. You don't want to be hopeless. There is some hope. Maybe if you've had something that set you back and really just sidelined you, there is a way that you can slowly step in through the slow lane. Don't just jump right onto the fast lane. Some people that can do that, great. But if you are not one of those people, don't stay out of it completely because you've got to start slow. Start slowly, work your way up, and you can reach some of these goals.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Maybe we should check back in June and see how those crunches and squats are going.
That's right.
That's Dr. Brandi Waite from UC Davis Sports Medicine. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. On Monday, Insight, as usual, at 9 a.m., we'll spend time looking at the career, the political career of Governor Jerry Brown, and then live coverage of the inauguration of California's new governor, Gavin Newsom, begins at 11 a.m. Hope you'll join us for that. Insight's producers are Cody Drabble, Jen Picard, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine. And the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said. I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching, and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for a man.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.